Here at the conclusion of the National Ethanol Conference, I'm with Bob Dineen, President and CEO of the Renewable Fuels Association. And Bob, I just wanted to go through the conference, the 20th annual conference here, and some of the takeaways that you had from the convention this year. So let's start off. Well, first person on the program was Chris Grundler with EPA, and I wanted to get your thoughts on the things that he had to say to this group after appearing last year to tell us that we were going to have an RFS rule by spring.
Well, I think that Chris, who's a solid professional and a good spokesperson for his agency, did a very good job. I was impressed that he actually took ownership of the fact that EPA indeed has not gotten the rule out and was man enough to apologize and recognizes that that impacts everybody negatively. He did express a lot of frustration about the process and the statute itself, which requires the EPA to do an annual rulemaking, and I feel for them. But you know what? Tough. You got to get it done, and they haven't. And he still doesn't have any answers. So while at the same breath that he was apologizing for not having gotten the rule done last year, he really offered no great confidence that the rule was going to get completed anytime soon this year. And you can only complain about lack of time and the difficulty of the process so much. At some point, you got to get it done. Now, it's not all Chris's fault. I know that he and his staff are working extraordinarily hard to get something done, and that there are other forces within the government that complicate his challenge. But so it's really it's more about how about the entire administration getting their act together and getting this done.
Our keynote speaker was Ron Kirk, who was a former U.S. Trade Representative under President Obama in his first term. And what did you think about the things that he had to say to this group?
I thought his message was a very constructive one. It's, you know, the power of trade, the importance of trade to the overall economy. You know, one of the stats that he used that really surprised me is that 98% of the trade in this country is done by small businesses, not big corporations. And that shocked me, and I think surprised a lot of other people in the room. Well, I mean, that's the ethanol industry in large part. And, you know, he was very good, I think, setting the tone for the conference, focusing on the important role of exports, not just to profitability, but to the nation's economy. And I was very impressed with him and encouraged by his comments.
The theme going global, this year you foregoed, that's not a word, this year you didn't have your normal international panel where you get to talk with some of your colleagues in other countries. Instead, we had Ed Hubbard with RFA moderating a panel to talk about the opportunities, the global opportunities for ethanol. Tell us a little bit about that panel and what you thought, because that really focused on the theme of going global.
Well, I did miss not having the opportunity to duel with my friends in Europe over their ridiculous anti-dumping duty. But, you know, people have probably seen that cage match more often than they really need to. And so as entertaining as it might have been for me, it may not have been for others. And really what we wanted to do this year is indeed, you know, focus on what are the growth opportunities. Okay, we know Europe is Europe, but let's talk about the Pacific Rim. Let's talk about India and Africa and other areas where there are real opportunities. Let's focus on Brazil, which will certainly be a growth opportunity for ethanol exports. And so I thought it was a great discussion. I think people were surprised to learn that we currently export to 51 countries and encouraged to know that there are increased market opportunities out there, and we just have to do the work to build those markets, educate countries about the opportunities that are there.
Well, and one of the people on that panel was USDA's Foreign Ag Service Representative Mike Dwyer. Is that his name? Mike Dwyer. And I thought some of the things that he had to say, particularly the help with USDA's help in growing these export markets, the way that they can help the ethanol industry when some of the other avenues were closed to them in the new farm bill, but also to be able to I didn't know where I was going with that. Anyway, but some of the other ways that they have some of the growth opportunities out there, and he also talked about the Grains Council and how the Grains Council, I think his word was, has developed markets out of thin air, particularly for distillers' grains. So tell a little bit about what USDA's FAS, how they can play a role in helping ethanol develop export markets.
Well, the FAS has been a great partner with the Grains Council, Growth Energy, and the RFA that has had an export program now for more than a year. And through the leadership of Secretary Vilsack, who has clearly put a focus on increasing export opportunities for U.S. ethanol, the FAS has helped identify where those markets might be. And certainly Mike Dwyer's a solid pro. He's been at the helm leading that effort. I was really pleased to have him here, and I look forward to working with Mike on this, you know, into the future.
Another big focus at the conference this year was cellulosic, the move into cellulosic, the fact that we have we kind of broke through the cellulosic barrier last year, and now what was kind of the question. And you also honored Quad County corn processors who produced the first gallons of cellulosic ethanol last year. So there's a real focus on that, and the panel discussed, where do we go from here?
Well, the industry is going to continue to evolve. Clearly, that panel discussion was important, and I was thrilled to have folks that are actually producing the juice that were able to talk about their experience, because in the past we've had folks up there and talking about the struggles to commercialization. And so having plants that are producing cellulosic ethanol today, not just Quad County, but also Abengoa, talking about the challenges now that they are producing cellulosic ethanol, what's it like trying to sell a D3 RIN, and are refiners really open to more cellulosic ethanol, and the importance of keeping the RFS in place, the importance of policy stability to make sure that we see more Quad Counties, and that we are building the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh plants out there. I thought the comments from DuPont that is soon to open up a commercial scale facility were also right on point. This is an industry that is continuing to evolve, but that's going to take policy certainty and a government that is committed to supporting biofuels.
Well, as you said that in your address, you said that the uncertainty in the government is kryptonite to advanced biofuels, right?
Yep, it is. The superpower of cellulose is nothing in the face of the kryptonite of uncertain policy and just, you know, either you support us or you don't. And what they've done with the RFS, what they've done with tax policy, the government writ large, and what they've done in terms of E15 and the handcuffs they place around that, their refusal to address the parity of RVP, their the way that they rolled E15 out in a bifurcated manner, only allowing it for 2001 and newer vehicles. You know, the administration has really not done much to build confidence in the market opportunities for higher level blends and cellulosic ethanol. So the fact that we were able to, you know, get folks that are making the juice today, it was very good.
Well, moving on to the second day, you really did a lot of focus on the world energy markets at this point and how ethanol fits in with that. Some of your takeaways from that.
Again, I thought a really good discussion about, you know, where oil prices are likely to go. The speaker made no specific predictions about the oil price, but clearly the supply and demand would suggest we are likely in a lower price oil environment for some time. But what I really liked about this conference is the industry has gone through tough times before, a couple of times, and they are ready for tough times ahead. There's no panic. There's no sense of desperation. There is nothing but a resolve that we're going to get through it. you know, we are buying in one commodity market and selling in another commodity market. So last year was a great year. This year may not be as great, but there is such a level of confidence of the producers that have ridden the tough times in the past that there's almost a sense of calm that while there may be stormy times ahead, not really going to be a problem for these guys. And that's a great atmosphere and vibe to have at a conference like this.
Well, our final panel was on rail transportation, the rail transportation issue, which really came to a head last year and has impacted the industry. And we've got some potential regulations that are going to impact the industry going forward. So your takeaways from that panel?
I thought that was one of the things I learned a lot from. One of our panelists gave specific data of the turnaround times for ethanol trains relative to crude oil trains. And my goodness, it is so crystal clear that railroads are prioritizing the shipment of crude oil while leaving ethanol to when it might be convenient for them to ship. And that is not right. I'm going to be following up with the National Transportation Safety Board and others in Washington, D.C., based on what I saw from that presentation, because it's just not right that railroads feel they can prioritize oil cars versus ethanol cars. It's something I've always felt. And I saw a news report last summer where one refiner outside of St. Louis was getting 10 unit trains a day, while I knew there were ethanol plants in Iowa and Minnesota and South Dakota that were having unit trains with their product held up for a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks. So, I mean, it's something that I knew from anecdotal reports, but seeing the data laid out as it was in this session was very eye-opening to me and very powerful. And, again, something I'll be using that data.
Well, and you talked about it in your address also, the safety issues. What do you feel like that ethanol is being possibly penalized by some of the unsafe practices and, you know, some of the accidents, the derailments that have happened that have been involving trains transporting oil?
Well, we arrived in Dallas to news reports of a horrific accident in Mount Carbon, West Virginia. You can't make that stuff up. Mount Carbon. And the fireball that ensued, the explosion, the environmental and safety risk that was evident with that explosion was contrasted for me with the accident, and accidents are going to happen, the previous week in Dubuque, Iowa, where, again, a train derailed, but you're dealing with a fire that first responders were allowed to just let burn out because it didn't pose much of a safety risk, and certainly hardly any environmental risk at all because of ethanol's biodegradation qualities. Ethanol is not highly volatile crude oil. It's not going to have the same explosivity. It is not going to have the same safety risk. It is most certainly not going to have the same environmental risk if leaked into water or near drinking water supplies. And that is something that the Department of Transportation and the Federal Railway Authority needs to be thinking about as they craft safety regulations for the 111 tank car. The ethanol industry has agreed to increased safety components to the 111 car. But I think it's crystally clear now that we do not need the same car that oil should have in order to assure the safe transport of highly volatile crude oil. And I'm hoping that the folks at OMB, because the rule is at OMB today, learned the right lesson from the past week and contrast the experience in Mount Carbon with the experience in Dubuque, Iowa. If so, it underscores the point that I've made all along. Ethanol is not crude oil. The other thing that these two accidents show, once again, keep the trains on the tracks, because there's no tank car ever in the history of rail has a tank car caused a derailment. And clearly that needs to be a factor in any effort to improve rail safety.
Well, and you pointed out ethanol's safety record, a transportation record, which is pretty significant.
Since 2006, 99.994% of our rail cars have arrived safely, and that continues to this day. Last year was a year in which we didn't see a single derailment. So we've done an awful lot to train our companies and do what we can to inform first responders of what to do should there be an accident. But we have taken safety very seriously, and I think it's maybe something that the oil industry could learn from us.
Overall, how do you feel about the 20th annual National Ethanol Conference?
I feel great. And mostly not because we had a great agenda, which I think that we did, and we had a great attendance, which we always do, but because the atmosphere in the room, the attitude of the producers that I talk to, the confidence that they continue to show in their industry. Again, this year is not going to be a repeat of last year, but they are braced for whatever comes their way, and we're not going away. The folks that have survived the last several downturns in the industry are braced for the future. And so I am made ever more ebullient by the enthusiasm and the confidence expressed by the ethanol producers that were here this week. So I walk away with an extra spring in my step.
All right. Thank you very much, Bob Dineen, here at the 20th National Ethanol Conference in Grapevine, Texas. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.